Physics Teaching Podcast. This is the podcast for teachers of physics made by physics teachers.
Physics teachers like me, Thomas WP, a part-time A-level mostly physics teacher.
And physics teachers like me, Robin Griffiths, a full-time teacher of physics all the way through from year 8 to year 13.
And physics teachers like our special guest, who has single-handedly charged us up the education podcast charts of Peru. You heard him at the start, Matt Bowman. Welcome to the podcast, Matt.
Yes, thank you, guys. A long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm a full-time head of physics, currently working in Peru, teaching ages 14 to 18.
And rather fantastic, I think you were probably our first podcast international listener.
Yeah, I started listening when I was teaching and working in Italy, basically when the podcast started, and I've kept that tradition on and hopefully introduced you to a few new listeners in Peru as well.
It's true. You're like spreading the word around the world. This is fantastic. You know, we don't even pay you. It's wonderful.
When we can pay people, I'll be retiring.
Yes, true.
So, Matt, there's so much to talk about. Firstly, thank you very much for being a loyal listener. We greatly enjoy getting the emails we get each month saying where we are on the Peru education charts, because it's the only charts we're on. But we thought we'd talk to you a bit about what it's like in Peru and the school you're at and how education works there. Because I thought that was very interesting when I worked abroad, was how the education system worked. And then we thought we'd grill you on this, you don't like practical work. So without further ado, do you mind telling us a bit about your school?
Absolutely, yes. So I joined the school just over a year ago. Previously, I worked in Italy, as I mentioned, in Milan, at a British international school there. And yeah, for a slight change of career, I came over to Peru. So the school I work at is a private all-girls school, and we're an all-through school. So we take students in from early years, and we go all the way through to what we call Form 6, which would be the equivalent of Year 13 in the UK. So the difference there is that legal education here finishes at what would be the end of Year 12. So we have some students who will stay on after their GCSEs for an extra year to do an internal program, or we'll have some students who will do the full two-year IB course. Obviously, a big difference there is that the second year isn't compulsory here, so we've got the students who are choosing to stay on, mainly for sort of reasons of university applications.
Ah, interesting. So it's sort of when you opt for university, you're opting also for another year of school to prepare you for university almost.
If they wish to go to international university, then usually yes. But the local universities here in Peru, they will accept a school transcript, so they don't need to have the IB examinations and so on. So we do have quite a lot of students who are interested in remaining in Peru, studying here, and they will follow the internal program for 1 year, and then they can apply to university sort of at 17 years old with that transcript.
And in terms of, you know, the curriculum and everything that you follow, I mean, obviously the IB curriculum is comparable to A levels here and so on and so forth. But is there a notion of a national curriculum for Peru?
Yeah, there is a national curriculum, and we still have to cover the points in that national curriculum. So it lines up very, very nicely with sort of the IGCSE and the IB curriculum. So we still submit planning documents to the government to show that we cover the national curriculum and so on. But by and large, everything we teach within the IGCSE and the IB is sort of part and parcel of the government curriculum too.
I was going to ask, is there a national exam they have to take at 16 that's the equivalent of the IGCSEs, or do you just do the IGCSEs instead?
Yeah, we do the IGCSEs, but there's no particular exam that they have to take. So the grading system here is different. Students are graded on a 1 to 20 scale, which they receive several times a year, and that's kind of averaged up. So it's similar to what I gather is the sort of GPA system in the US, and schools sort of award those on sort of fixed criteria. And very often, students who are applying to university, that's the criteria that would be looked at within the country.
So a full teacher assessment like we did in the UK this year?
Yeah, basically like that. So we, at our school, we grade them, our year is broken into four bimesters. So we have a grade every bimester. And then for most year groups, we'll run an end of year examination, obviously excluding the exam group years.
I'm intrigued by this four bimesters. How does the academic year work?
So obviously we're the Southern Hemisphere, so I know obviously in the UK you guys are just coming out of summer now and we're just heading into it. So I say I'm finally looking for some sunshine, but winter here doesn't really drop below 15 degrees. so our academic year starts in March and goes through to December. We have our winter break in July, so we have 3 weeks off in July, and then it's sort of like half terms either side, so sort of two major semesters with a half term in the middle of them.
So Matt, if somebody's listening and they're thinking about teaching internationally, and I know a lot of teachers sort of do think about that as an option occasionally, what in your mind are the pros and cons? You lots of experience in this area, you've taught in Italy as well as Peru, so what would you advise?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously made the choice quite early on in my career. I was only sort of 23 years old, no mortgage, no family to really worry about. So I sort of had the freedom to do that. But it is a big jump. You know, moving to another country, a country where maybe you don't speak the language, different culture. It's certainly not a decision to be taken lightly, I think. Something I found moving, obviously, to Italy was still fairly close to home, so I could jump on a plane and fly home in 2 hours. But right now, obviously, it takes me a day I wanted to get home at best. So I think that's certainly something to think about carefully. But the opportunities are fantastic. I've worked with teachers from so many different countries in the world, had the opportunity to learn new languages, had the opportunity to teach different exams, so teaching with the IGCSE and in particular the IB curriculum, which I think has a lot of strengths. I really think that curriculum develops really strong learners across the board, not just in the physics program, but with the essay writing skills and the other subjects they take. So I really think the bonus is opportunity is trying new things, both personally and professionally, and the opportunity to see some different types of schools that maybe have a very different ethos to what's taught in the UK, schools that have a very multicultural student and parent base, and sort of lots of expertise to draw on there.
And so you went from Italy to Peru. Do you think you'll sort of carry on the journey and travel to more countries? Do you think you've become effectively an international teacher now?
I do like to think of myself as an international teacher, certainly. It is wonderful being able to travel. I think that teaching is one of those jobs that may not be obvious at first, but if you're a qualified teacher from the UK in particular, where the PGCE program is very well respected, you have the opportunity to work in almost any country in the world. And you only need to sort of look online onto the sort of job adverts. I know the TES run a lot of international adverts just to see the opportunities. So I would like to stay teaching internationally. Obviously, I do still, you know, UK is still home for me and I do still go home to visit my family. But I think it's so interesting to actually live and work in another country, not just being on holiday there. It's a really, really great opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point you made there, actually, because it's one that we tend to be, you know, as teachers, you know, every teacher likes a moan, and teachers in the UK, we tend to be quite down on our education system, but it is one of our most successful exports in that sense.
Yeah, I know that, you know, so many international schools are so interested in British qualified teachers. The British PGCE route is so well respected, and you know, the associated qualifications given out by universities in the UK in education, it's still an absolute hallmark of quality worldwide. I think that's why you see so many, not just international schools, but British international schools on every continent, practically.
And Matt, do you have a feel for, is physics a particularly short subject? I mean, it's a shortage subject here in the UK. Is it a shortage subject in international schools around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly something I've noticed being part of international physics departments for a couple of years, is that physics teachers aren't easy to come by. And I know, obviously, when you guys started the podcast, you were talking about the unfortunate non-specialists who've been dragged in to teach a period of physics a week. And, you know, there is still that. I think in the international sector, that maybe happens a little less, partly because particular schools I've worked in tend to be slightly smaller. So one or two physics teachers can normally cover all of the physics requirements. But yeah, physics teachers are still very, very difficult to come by.
So it looks like I can hear the sounds of suitcases being snapped open around the country, dusted off and snapped open as people think about this. It's certainly a very beguiling prospect. I know, Thomas, you taught abroad for a bit, but are you ever tempted to teach internationally again?
Yeah, absolutely. I am, but I don't think I can persuade my darling wife. I think she had one go. She was very keen, but after one go, she's not quite so keen.
She got that out of her system.
But, you know, I would do it. I mean, I think if I did it again, I probably would go to an international school. And I sort of have dreams of going and working in an international school in Europe somewhere and teaching the children of professional cyclists so I can get my fix of pro cycling. But it's a pipe dream. It's not going to happen.
Oh, well, you never know. Maybe one day, maybe Mrs. WP, the scales will fall for her MRIs and she'll be off. But
I'll be retired.
Yeah. But Matt, so, I mean, it sounds like that you're pretty settled in Peru for the time being. So you plan to stay there for a while, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, in the international sector, it's normally common to be on fixed-term contracts as well. So I'm on a fixed-term contract until the end of next year, in the next academic year. And then obviously at some point there'll be a discussion with the head about where we want to go, what we want to be doing, and we have that discussion about the new contract. So it is, I suppose, a little different in that sense from in the UK, where you normally sign on the dotted line and you're there. Here there is sort of that fixed term nature to it. So it's certainly a little different in the international sector in that response, but in that sense. But yeah, it's a great place to be.
And that, I suppose, actually, the other thing about that is it would be tempted to see that from the British perspective and not giving you much job security. But in fact, actually, it's there to protect both sides, isn't it? Because, you know, at some stage after a couple of years, you might decide you want to move on. It's more likely if you don't have roots in a place that you would want to move on, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And, you know, I think that obviously in international schools, when you're hiring people that may be coming from other countries, I think it is there to protect the school a little. It's not really something I've ever experienced, but I can understand the risks of hiring somebody who's come from another country where, you know, you don't have that local heads group or local discussion. But yeah, I've never really felt sort of that I've not had the job security. I think that really, as long as you're happy to move on, the school are happy to move on, it's never really been an issue. I've never had any difficult conversations in that respect.
And I suppose the final thing that other people might be thinking about if they're thinking about the move abroad is the money. I'm not going to ask you how much you're being paid, don't worry, but how do salaries work? Are they comparable with local salaries? Are they sort of judged on a British teacher scale? Are they generous? Are they less generous? What sort of things do you have to look out for?
It varies very much country to country, certainly. In my experience, international teaching certainly isn't badly paid. I wouldn't say that you're going to become an overnight millionaire teaching in an international school, but yeah, it is sort of judged on a local level. So it will vary country to country, and a lot of countries, so for example, here I'm paid in dollars because the country has a slightly more unstable currency. So that's certainly, if you're looking at international teaching, is worth looking at what the currency that you would be paid in. But yeah, I think that there are some very lucrative schools on offer. I know a lot of schools in Asia offer very, very lucrative packages, particularly in terms of things like return flights, accommodation, expenses paid, and so on. So there's certainly some money to be made out there. But it's, I think, as with any job, it's always worth just checking exactly what the conditions are, contract length, expectations, and so on.
And presumably for those most lucrative of jobs, you presumably have to have a little bit of time on the circuit behind you, or it's probably beneficial to have a little bit of time on the circuit behind you before you go for those?
Yeah, that's generally what I've sort of seen. And I know that IB teaching is sort of the international, the standard for international schools. So experience in teaching IB is always advantageous. And there is often, with those incredibly lucrative schools, often other expectations, such as there may be a boarding school, so there's boarding work to be done, sort of, you know, 5.5 days a week of teaching or so on. It's always worth just sort of looking at the context and the background of the school before jumping headfirst into an application.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, as with all these things, any job application that you do in teaching, it's worth an informal chat with somebody at the school before you start, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly useful. I was able to chat to a colleague who I work with in Italy, who used to work in Peru, who knew somebody. There's very much somebody knows somebody kind of relationship there, but I mean, that's where places like Twitter come in incredibly handy, and building up those professional networks where you can reach out to somebody and say, you know, do you know somebody who works here, or somebody who's done this or took this step, to get that real on the ground information.
Now, going back to those awkward conversations, Matt, you say awkward conversations, but I'm assuming those are about your distrust of practical work.
Yeah, so I knew this one was going to come back to bite me somewhat. I wouldn't say distrust. I think I would say a healthy skepticism of practical work. No, I do a lot of practical work. I think practical work is incredibly important in science. But I think where I sort of would have caution is, why are you doing practical work? And I think that's something that it's easy to get lost when we've got a million and one things to plan in a day, printing to do, grades to fill in, and we're planning a lesson and we just go, I'll do the Hooke's Law practical. We'll just stick that in there, get the springs and the masses out and the rulers and send the kids off while we sort of circulate a room and make sure nobody breaks a spring and gets it in their eyeball. So I think it's that question of why are we doing this practical? Are we trying to develop practical skills in the students? Are we trying to get them to be better investigators? Or are we trying to teach a point? Are we trying to teach them theory through practical and making sure that what we do is well structured around that? Because, like I say, I think practical work is easy to plan lazily, I would say.
It's worth noting at this point that we're talking to Matt before we release the podcast, before this episode, in which we talk about that exact point with James De Winter, who says, you know, that Matt, the practical's great, but there must be a reason for doing it. And that is important. I think it's a very valid point. If you do it for practical sake, maybe you shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, I fully agree. It is important that we're doing practical work right, and it's not just about going through the motions, write a method, collect the results, draw a graph. That we're actually thinking about, well, why are we doing that? You know, do we need to maybe just focus on drawing the graph today? Are we really wanting to develop those graph drawing skills? If so, you know, should we be providing the students with some sample results if their practical goes wrong? Should we be giving them a pre-printed table so they don't have to worry about, you know, drawing that up and really focus on what our specific teaching point is?
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's something I learned through the CPAC stuff, the new CPAC, or relatively new CPAC for A-level, which is you need to concentrate on those skills. And if you're doing a data analysis skill, then show them a video of the practical and give them the results. And it takes 2 minutes, 5 minutes, and then they've got the results. And then the practice is, can you analyze the data? Can you get a result? So that's something that did change in my practice with the CPAC, and particularly after I'd done the training when I did the practical advisor role.
Yeah, I think, I mean, as at the IB, 25% of our grade is what we call the IA, the internal assessment. And that consists of a student designing, researching their own practical, carrying it out and writing quite an extensive lab report, sort of 6 to 12 pages. So it is something that we do focus on. But I think it's important to really focus on building each skill very well rather than just trying to get the students to do a full practical every single time where they may be sort of scrambling to complete parts or complete part of the lab report and not really learn how to do any part particularly well.
Yeah, that's exactly what I saw on some schools when I did that role, is that the kids had 12 required practicals on the AQA course, and I'd see lab books with just 12 practicals written up beautifully, obviously copied out into neat. And that's not what CPAC is about. And so you say it's about 6 to 8 pages, so you would maybe skill them up over a period of weeks. This is how you present a results table. This is how you get data into a graph. This is how you get a gradient, all that. And you build those up. And then come the end of 1 year, isn't it, from what you're saying, then you say, right, go design your practical and write it up with the skills I've given you. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's pretty much how we do it. So we sort of try to split it up into the design phase, the data collection and processing phase, the analysis, and then the evaluation. That's sort of the criteria that they're graded on. So I would only really try to focus on one of those. So if we're focusing on designing an experiment, then we focus on the design and we don't actually worry too much about, we will collect the results and we'll look at them, but we'll do that as a class and we'll do that together to be very guided. But we'd really encourage the students to focus on designing a good experiment, and the same for all the other sections, which by the time they come around to doing their IA, I would have hoped that they'd done 8 to 9 different experiments with a focus on a particular area.
Yeah, no, I think this is really interesting because I think one of the things that I realised early doors, particularly when people came to observe my lessons who were non-scientists, non-science teachers, they used to sort of talk about practical as if it was some sort of glorified group activity. And I always sort of thought, well, there's more to it than that. You know, practical investigation is a huge part of the scientific method, and it's got more to it than that. And so trying to judge it on you know, the usual standards that you might have for a group activity in science is just touching a group activity in any lesson is just scraping the surface of what it's supposed to be doing. And I think that's perhaps what you're getting at a bit there, Matt. It's this idea that the practical works aren't just a sort of a way of getting kids active in a lesson, that they're actually, the whole idea of practical investigation is a real deep part of the scientific method. I remember the Rev who Thomas and I used to teach with, when he did A-level practicals, he would basically give his students basically handouts that pretty much covered everything bar the one specific, like if he wanted them really to focus in on uncertainties, for example, he'd leave the results table for them to do, and that alone. So everything else was almost done for them, or they were led through it very, very swiftly, if you like, to get to the point that he wanted to discuss, which was the results table. And I always really liked that, because it was exactly that. It was just zeroing in on the skill you wanted them to deal with.
Yeah, I think that sounds like, you know, an absolutely good way to plan it out and to make sure that, yeah, you're focusing on what you want to focus on.
Yeah, I'm doing this tomorrow, actually, with my upper sixth. We missed, of course, a lot of practical work in lockdown, but we're doing Charles Law. And I've said to them, all you are doing is getting the length of the column of gas for a range of temperatures and then plotting a graph and extrapolating to the x-axis in intercept. So I'm no write-up of what they actually do, no diagram of the equipment, just a results table and the analysis.
I think the good news is here, though, that it's basically we don't have to worry about an internecine feud here, because fundamentally it sounds like, Matt, you are a big fan of practical work, actually, but you're a big fan of effective practical work, which is fine, because I was worried that Thomas was going to have to affix you with a particularly hard stare at one point, so that's good.
Yeah, I think that, like you said there, practical work, yeah, done well, done for a purpose with a plan in place, and not just, you know, writing a requisition sheet 10 minutes before the lesson and hoping that that you make it through.
Absolutely.
10 minutes before the lesson. It's a week in my place. now, you love practical, Matt. Now, you must have known this was coming. Is there a practical which you are particularly fond of, which you would want to be remembered for when you retire? Practical in memoriam. Is there something that you have up your sleeve? You must have thought of this.
That was probably the hardest part of planning for this podcast, was trying to think what my practical in memoriam would be. And I'm going to go completely against everything I've said now and give something really, really vague. For me, my favourite is deducing the speed of light using a microwave oven. I'm sure lots of teachers know this, but you take the turntable out of the microwave and put in a plate with something like, I normally use the really cheap sort of plasticky sliced cheese, and just turn the microwave on. And you get the spots melting at the sorts of peaks and troughs of the standing wave. You can measure the distance between those. You can use the frequency that's given on the microwave. And from that, you can find to a very, very good degree of accuracy the speed of light. So the reason that sort of goes against what I said earlier is that my favorite time I did that practical was my very first lesson with my year 13 class when I joined the school in Italy. And I just gave them a microwave, some various foods, some plates, a load of equipment, and told them to find the speed of light. And didn't really give them anything more. But that was my way of getting to know the class, of seeing who would immediately just start trying things, who would sit down and write a plan, who would, for example, account for the uncertainties in their measurements. Were they thinking of that? So I think it's a very versatile experiment. It's one you can do as a demonstration when you're introducing the wave equation. It's something you could do to introduce uncertainties, because you know, you've got blobs of melted cheese, where exactly do you measure between? I think it's just got a lot of nice different uses for it.
Very nice. I seem to remember seeing it being done with a really big bar of Cadbury's Dairy Milk Chocolate, which I think went down very well with the class involved.
Yeah, I've never heard of cheese. I've done it with raw egg. I've done it with marshmallows. I've done it with chocolate. Never cheese.
Marmalade sandwich? No.
No.
That would be quite messy, I think. I found the cheese works very nicely, because you can get a very nice flat sort of layer of cheese. Whilst I've tried the chocolate, it's definitely a lot tastier. With the bumps and grooves on the chocolate, it can interfere with the melting a little.
Yeah, I like the cheese idea. The marshmallows is good. You put them all squashed in a big rectangle, and single marshmallows melt, and that's pretty nice.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I like that. That's good.
And the egg one's great, because it cooks, and that's really, really nice, because it's transparent. Because those microwave plates have a little lip, don't they? So you crack an egg into it. I think I took the yolk out, so I just had white, and then just put it in, and then you get little cooked points. Brilliant.
I wouldn't want to leave it running for too long, though. I think the smell of the lab afterwards with an overcooked egg might not be the greatest.
Yes, yeah, the tidying up perhaps isn't as good on that one, but it's very impressive, very easy to see where the hot spots are.
Absolutely. I think Mrs. Brown wouldn't be very happy if you'd used her oven like that, would she?
You said you're going to keep these under your hat, Robin.
Oh,
well, I had to know they were coming at some point.
I'm ticking them off as I go.
people who have never heard of Paddington Bear, then there's plenty of people listening who won't have heard of that need to, going to be so confused.
There'll be a link in the show notes, people. Matt's pretty sitting there going, oh, I wish people had stopped with the Paddington jokes every time.
I bet we're the first people he's spoken to since he moved to Peru who've mentioned Paddington Bear.
I'm sure.
Yeah, there's definitely not a giant statue a few blocks from my house or anything like that.
I seem to remember going to Paddington Station, and rather wonderfully, there is a massive statue there, which I did think was quite nice. I don't know why that made me laugh.
Oh, Paddington Bear. Right. Well, Matt, that's absolutely fantastic. I love that practical too, and it's good to mention it as much as possible. I've never actually done it as a give the microwave to the kids and ask them to measure the speed of light with a few foods. I think that's a great idea. But thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me, guys. It's been great to get on. And I know I said in an email too, I think, you know, this podcast has been fantastic CPD. I think it's a podcast without a particular agenda. It's not trying to sell a product. It's just physics teachers talking about physics. And it's something we don't get to do enough.
Don't forget the vacuum cannons.
Oh, sorry. And the vacuum cannon.
Still one in stock as we record. Still one in stock.
Remember, listener, still a vacuum cannon available. Buy yours now to avoid disappointment. Yes, we're not trying to sell it. You're right, Matt. Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't really want to explain to customs in Peru why I'm ordering a cannon, so I may leave that one till I'm back in the UK.
Well, I just write on the box, plastic tube and ping pong balls. Doesn't need to be a cannon, does it?
That is true.
So thank you, Matt, and thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Thomas.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Physics Teaching Podcast, and special thanks this week to Matt Bowman. The podcast is presented by me, Thomas WP, and Robin Griffiths, and produced and edited by me, Thomas WP, with the show notes done by Robin. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you next week.